supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I had a mastectomy, I had a lobe removed from my lung, and that was that. So I haven't really pursued anything with the cancer. I don't think I'm in denial. I've done what I have to do. I came mainly because I was so glad he wanted to do this.
Many of the participants said writing helps them understand their own reaction to their illness and to communicate better with family, friends, and doctors. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
In sports, Flyers beat the Ducks in overtime 4-3. They're in Phoenix tonight, action beginning at 8. This is WHYY.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. And you know, we didn't plan it that way, but we have a wood-boring insect special this week. The question of the week is all about termites. And in a very special interview we'll talk to a representative from the Nature Conservancy about how moving firewood around is enabling these bark-eating beetles who are decimating our forests. And of course, we got to get lots of your wood-eating phone calls in there, too, at 1-888-346-9499. Barry, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike. Thank you.
Oh, hello, Barry. Thank you. How are you, man?
I'm doing rather well. I'm sitting around in the dark having a chat with you.
Okay. Why are you in the dark, may I ask?
Well, I'm calling from Brussels in Belgium, which is basically the country north of France, south of Holland.
Now, how do you hear our show?
Oh, I'm a podcast fanatic. You know, I like to garden, went onto podcasts with iTunes and stuff, did some research, looked around, traipsed across shows. And, you know, my father used to sit at the kitchen table with a shortwave radio and listening to radio shows all over the world, and I do the same thing, but with podcasts.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, it really is kind of the same kind of culture. That's wonderful.
It's the evolution of it, yeah.
I'm glad you found us. Okay, so what's going on? What can we do for you?
I live in a very heavily shaded garden area. It's an old factory where we used to have a concrete floor that got picked out, heavy packed in clay.
Really?
And they planted trees there before they did any treatment to the soil. And they planted the root ball about 20, 25 centimeters deeper than the surface of the soil. And, of course, 1, 2, 3 trees died.
Oh, what a sin.
We got to the third tree this year. Well, it's almost dead. It was just barely hanging on. In September, there were no leaves on the tree at all. Everything was shed. But we pulled it out of the ground, lifted it up to root level, again, to the surface level, and replanted it in the hopes that in this improved soil and with the elevation, so the roots, the bark, isn't buried in the soil, we could make it survive. And I know how much you detest the idea of mulches touching trees, and I can't imagine what you think about being buried.
One of the first things I was taught back when I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine is that a lot of people who even consider them professionals plant trees too deeply. They like to see this lollipop coming out of the ground, and the sign of an intelligent tree planting is when you can see the dramatic root flare above ground, that musculature of the tree. And when you don't see it, it means that some of the bark is underground and being covered and kept moist. And that's exactly the same danger as when people foolishly mound mulch around the bark. It's exactly the same thing. The bark is supposed to be exposed to the air and breathe, and anything that keeps it wet, as you know, can rot the bark or girdle it or allow little voles or other rodents to get under there and eat away that tender bark undetected. So they had been in this improper planting for around 3 or 4 years?
Yeah, from day one, but it's running 3 to 4 years.
It seems like you may have pulled the drowning person out of the water just in time.
I would like that.
So you've raised the tree up, you improved the soil a little bit around its base.
It's one of these tragic aspects of community gardening. People do things the wrong way, and after they bury the tree, and I'd sort of begged them to wait until we improved the soil, then we brought in 8 cubic meters of black soil and put in this beautiful deep level, which has helped enormously. But, of course, that just made everything worse and worse. But now it's been raised up. The roots have a place to run now.
Okay, very good. I'm very impressed that you were able to raise up the tree. Were the roots kind of stunted underground?
Oh, enormously.
And you can see the root flare.
You can see the flare.
Okay,
yes.
And the soil is nice and black kind of around the tree, so every time it rains, the tree gets a little bit of, like, a compost tea feeding.
It's in a decent situation. The roots are there, but, you know, once we improved the soil, they left it without treatment for 2 years, and so even in a rain situation, our garden goes back to frequent flooding pockets.
Oh, okay, yeah. When exactly did you levitate the tree?
2 weeks ago.
Oh, okay. So we haven't been through a cycle yet, and your seasons are much the same as ours. You're entering your dormant season now.
Well, we're entering the same dormant season I heard you talking about on the last show, which is this freakishly cold and warm and cold and warm.
Yeah, exactly. So I would say don't do anything else now. Over the winter, try to locate some compost or worm castings.
And I actually have packs of worm castings in my back room. I grow my own worms, we could say.
Very good. You and I both.
They're adorable.
They are. They're really cute.
We have the Royal Gardens up here, the Botanical Gardens up here. They collect all the leaves, which have been run through a mower and mulched.
Right.
And I can go up and take an unlimited amount of leaf mulch.
You could do some leaf mulch. That is typically a better idea where you've got sandy soil and the soil dries out.
Mm-hmm.
You have the opposite problem. So what I would do is just let the tree go dormant through fall and winter. And in the spring, when it starts to green up, lay down like a solid half an inch of worm casting, starting about 6 inches away from the trunk and going out as far as the furthest piece of root.
You know, the thing I find about worm castings in the pot that I use, if I put in sort of a top layer of the worm castings, they can become sort of this dried out marbled type surface, which I always thought is, you know, I should mix it with soil and make it a bit more agreeable to saturation.
You could do what they used to call scratching it in to the surface of the soil, mix it in with a little bit of that good black dirt, and if you want, like a half an inch of the leaf mulch on top might actually be a very good idea. It might keep the worm castings moist and really activate them.
Okay.
All right. Well, Barry, we wish you great luck with your tree here, man.
Thank you for your time.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Kathy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Kathy. I am well. I trust you are as well.
Yes, I am. Yes, I am.
And
except for my little problem.
And where is Kathy well?
Chester Springs, Pennsylvania.
Very good. What is your little problem, Kathy, in Chester Springs?
My problem is I have two wonderful dogs. The issue is that when I let them out the side door of our house, they have a bad habit of peeing right off the bottom of the steps in like a couple foot area, and they have completely destroyed the grass in that area. The rest of the lawn around it looks beautiful. So my question is two part. Number one, what would you recommend to hopefully regrow the grass in that area? What's the best time of year, best type of grass? Is there a better grass that would hold up better for like foot traffic and stuff by animals?
Nah.
Then number two, once we regrow the grass, is there any tips you might have to keep them off the grass?
As you might suspect, this is a very frequently asked question. So
okay.
This is something we know a lot about. Now, what kind of grass do you have in your backyard?
I'm not really sure. We moved into our house about a year ago, and it was new construction, so it was sod. I know that. They laid it down.
Oh, okay. And is the lawn in sun or shade?
That side gets some sun, but not full sun all day.
Well, let's put it this way. The parts of the lawn that the dogs didn't tear up but that were exposed to the stresses of the weather over summer, are there any bare spots or does it fill in its own bare spots pretty
much? No, it fills in its own bare spots. It's looking good.
Then it will do the same for the doggy area once we relieve the pressure.
Oh, okay.
Well, there's two kinds of grasses. There's essentially cool season grasses and warm season grasses. By definition, unless you have zoysia grass that turns brown in the winter, you have a cool season grass. And inside the cool season grasses, there's two kinds. There's running grasses that do well in sun and clumping grasses that do well in shade. So the fact that yours has filled in any of its own bare spots means it's a running grass and it can fill in this area where the dogs have ruined portions of it.
Okay.
Because bluegrass will always regrow to cover its own bare spots. Now, there's a couple of issues involved. One of the issues, one of the ways to dilute the problem is to dilute the problem. The worst damage to grasses occur when dogs go without adequate water or go a long time in between passes outside, but especially if water is withheld. The more water they drink, the less concentrated this nitrogen is. And even though you think, well, they're going to pee more, so it's going to do more damage, the opposite is true. The more dilute their pee, the more they have free access to water, the less damage it will do to grass. Since you are opening the door to let them out, you can be there with a hose or a watering can in the short run. Once they've done what they're doing, all you need to do is flush it, so to speak, just like when we do it.
Okay.
And that is to soak the area well with water. And then long term, what you want to do is just let one of them out at once with a handler. You want to get them to the very back of the yard, the side of the yard, an area maybe where there's stones or it's not going to be so obvious.
Okay.
And you're going to drag them back there really quickly. And then when they pee, you're going to reward them. You're going to give them a treat. You're going to praise them. So after a week of this kind of conditioning, they should run to that area themselves, especially if every once in a while you still give up the treat. If in the spring this area looks really, truly, most sincerely dead,
mm-hmm.
you can grub out some of the dead grass, and that will create an entry point for the healthy grass around it to regrow into that area.
Okay. Okay, great.
All right. Good luck, Kath.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody that a Christmas tree you cut locally or have cut for you at a local Christmas tree farm will stay fresher, hold its needles much longer, and keep your Christmas carbon footprint on Santa's super nice list. But don't you go browsing through lists of local tree farms to visit just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls. How to keep termites out of your house without doing anything inside your house or touching your house, and why you shouldn't help wood-boring insects by moving firewood around. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
It's 11:19. This is WHYY.
Newsworks.org is your source for smart stories that keep you better informed, better connected, and better prepared. Our network of quality journalists is a step above the rest, and better coverage of important issues means you'll always be a step ahead. Newsworks is something different. News for people who ask more. News for people who care, by people who care. Get involved at newsworks.org. Newsworks is, simply, news that works. Powered by WHYY and you.
Sign up now for classes at WHYY's Dorrance H. Hamilton Public Media Commons. Starting December 12th, learn how to turn your favorite snapshots into a multimedia slideshow. For more information, visit whyy.org/Hamilton Commons.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, some people install trenches to keep termites out of their house. Some people flip out and have their house fumigated if they think there's termites inside. There is a much simpler and kind of astonishing solution that can keep your house termite-free from the outside, even after the little buggers have gotten in. You won't want to miss it. And we're going to be taking lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it is time for our special interview about why we shouldn't be moving firewood around. Our special guest, Lee Greenwood, is the Coalitions and Networks Manager for the Nature Conservancy Forest Health Program. She joins us through the auspices of KUFM in Missoula, Montana. Lee, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for being with us. Now, you are in the middle of a program that is essentially begging people not to move firewood from state to state. Is that correct?
Yes, we've been around since 2008 as the Don't Move Firewood campaign. And the basics of the campaign is that you should not move firewood very far at all, and certainly not over state lines or over 50 miles.
And one of the main reasons, if not the reason here, is to try and control the spread of these horrible bark-eating beetles that are devastating so many of our favorite trees?
Certainly, there's a ton of beetles that could be moved through the movement of firewood, but there's also all sorts of other pests like funguses, bacteria, small insects, you know, all sorts of different things can lurk inside of firewood, because firewood often comes from dead and dying trees that may have been plagued by some sort of pest.
Right, and with these bark-eating beetles that have exploded in the past couple of years, that is what everyone tells a tree owner or the forestry service in that area to do, is to cut them down and destroy the trees right away, because there's no cure for this, and get the tree cut down and destroy it as quickly as possible so the beetles don't spread to the next tree, right?
That's exactly right. An infested tree could serve as a breeding ground for other trees on your property or other trees in the county or region. So what you should do indeed is either cut it down yourself if you feel you can do that safely, or get a certified tree service to do it, and then use the firewood on site, or if you need to, you know, give it to your next door neighbor, but don't move it very far and don't give it away for free on the roadside where people could take it a long distance.
I remember when I was researching an older termite article down south, especially after a hurricane or some sort of natural disaster, that one of the ways some of the more exotic termites were spreading through the United States was through scrap wood and infested trees that were being shipped almost deliberately out of state to be used for firewood.
Well, there's many, many things that move on firewood. One particular one that's native that could be a problem is the mountain pine beetle. But it's certainly not native to my backyard in the middle of an urban area. And that's where you get the problem, is you could accidentally take a tree out of a national forest with your firewood permit, cut it for firewood, bring it to your house, and then destroy your property value by infesting your own backyard with these pests through infested firewood.
When we were talking about having you on the show, I asked you to bone up on these beetles. The Asian longhorn beetle is a huge menace here in our area. Are there any others that your campaign, the Nature Conservancy's Don't Move Firewood program, is focusing on, that you think you can really help control the spread? Or conversely, if people just move firewood with abandon, they have a real good chance of moving this specific pest around?
Oh, absolutely. In the southwestern United States, the gold-spotted oak borer, which is a small beetle with gold spots, it's a huge menace, but has a very limited area. And so the movement of firewood in the region of San Diego is particularly troublesome, because that pest could really explode. The emerald ash borer is widespread.
That's one of our worst right now. And I apologize for interrupting you, but every time I think of this dratted insect, and here I'm revealing my Philadelphia roots, I mean, this creature has ruined the game of organized baseball.
Oh, I know. It's terrible. You know, the American tradition of using ash for the best baseball bats is really threatened. We may not always be able to use that particular tree for this, you know, critical sporting event. And that's just one of the results of moving firewood that's really tragic, that you might not think of off the top of your head, that we need to prevent from happening. You don't want to move firewood because you don't want to imperil any of these traditions.
So I interrupted you with the emerald ash borer.
Emerald ash borer is one of the biggest issues on firewood, because the particular pest just transmits really easily. There's often lots of them in a piece of firewood. And it's spread so fast across the eastern United States because of firewood. There's really no debating that. There's many states in New England that do not have emerald ash borer. And so it's critical that people who live in areas with emerald ash borer, or anywhere near somewhere with emerald ash borer, not move firewood to prevent the movement of that particular pest.
And as you mention our more northern regions, it's really easy to see people visiting family. They're driving a pickup truck. Hey, we just took this tree down. We know you burn cords and cords of wood to heat your house over the winter. You want to take a half a cord or a cord with you? Why wouldn't you?
Well, there's significant fines involved in moving firewood across certain boundaries, like some state lines and some county lines. And for instance, the state of New York, you're not permitted to move it more than 50 miles without proper certification, which is not something that, you know, the public really wants to deal with. The fines are there not because, you know, we need to fine people for this behavior, but because it's incredibly expensive to eradicate these pests. So it's a preventative measure.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I know we are spending a lot of money. I don't think we're doing very well at eradicating these pests, Lee.
Some pests have had very successful eradications, and it's important to remember that if these pests are discovered quickly, we do have a chance of eradicating them. For instance, in Chicago, the Asian longhorn beetle was successfully eradicated, and that was a pretty significant infestation that was completely removed. Another excellent example is the citrus longhorn beetle that affected a small area near Seattle quite a few years ago. That pest was fully eradicated, and the citrus longhorn beetle is a very dangerous pest.
Now, you are in the Nature Conservancy's Forest Health Program. You're director of this Don't Move Firewood program. Obviously, the Nature Conservancy, the health of the forest, it is their main objective, one would assume. How threatening are these various, and you've even mentioned beyond the bark-eating beetles, which are getting all the press, of various fungal and bacterial organisms that I imagine are also attacking trees and making them less healthy and decimating stands of certain types of trees?
These things, you know, they take out entire species groups, like the Emerald Ash Borer. It takes out all the ash trees. So you could easily imagine a forest becoming one remaining type of tree instead of the beautiful natural diversity that our native forests have.
And as the world gets smaller, these threats grow astronomically.
Oh, yes. They move very quickly because people move them accidentally on firewood. They come into the country more rapidly as a result of an increase over time of imports of goods. The problem is increasing, but of course, our ability to fight the problem is increasing with greater public awareness through the Don't Move Firewood campaign and just through general alertness of citizens to look for unusual damage or unusual insects on their trees and report them immediately to county extension officers or local agriculture officials.
With all these imported pests attacking almost every type of tree, has one pest or another going after it, this really is a time when people need to pay attention to their trees and wake up if a tree fails to leaf out or if they notice holes in the bark. And anything else come to mind?
Certainly. Sometimes trees under stress from insects or diseases will have really funny leafy shoots coming out of the bottom of them. It's very strange looking. So that's one example. Sometimes they ooze either because of a fungus or because the sap is coming out of the holes. In the case of some of the bigger insects, sometimes sawdust actually collects at the bottom of the tree, which is kind of shocking. And that's actually sawdust created by the insects that's falling onto the ground.
And I guess the takeaway message you want people to have is not only don't move firewood, but be aware and speak up if somebody in your family, one of your friends says they're going to bring a load back from fill in the blank, this is the time to speak up and say, maybe that isn't the best idea.
Absolutely. It's not the best idea to move firewood very long distances. Another thing that's important, too, this time of year, is it's not a good idea to move holiday greenery really long distances. Things like Christmas trees and wreaths that are moved long distances could also transmit insects and diseases. So that's something to keep in mind for the holidays.
All right. Lee Greenwood is Coalitions and Networks Manager for the Nature Conservancy Forest Health Program. She joined us today from the studios of KUFM in Missoula, Montana, to talk about the Nature Conservancy's very important Don't Move Firewood program. Lee, I wish you great luck with getting your message out. Remember, Major League Baseball and good quality bats are depending on you to do your good job. And in a less lighthearted note, so are our forests. And as you say, the amazing diversity of trees that we enjoy now, they could vanish if we don't pay attention and do the right thing.
That's right. And to that end, to tell your friends and your neighbors, you should friend us on Facebook. We have a presence called Don't Move Firewood, and you can become our friend and see all sorts of important updates about pests in all different regions. Or nature.org or don'tmovefirewood.org.
Okay. All right. Lee Greenwood telling us not to move firewood on behalf of the Nature Conservancy. Great message. Thanks for being with us, Lee.
Thank you very much.
And now back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Pat, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, how you doing, bud?
I'm doing okay, Pat. How are you, sir?
Doing just fine down here in the sunny capital of Cass County, Linden, Texas.
Oh, man, you had too much sun this year.
Oh, it was horrible. Had a horrible drought, and like to burnt my azaleas plum up. We've had a little bit of rain this week, and that's greened everything up, and it's tried to catch up, but it's the things that just the lack of water finally just got to some of the stuff and stressed it out. Had a lot of oak trees stressed out and everything else, but mainly what I'm calling about is my azaleas in my front yard, and they have just completely turned brown, but they're starting to have a little bit of green come back.
Well, I am sorry about that, and I'm sorry about what I'm about to say. Azaleas are one of the most water-hungry plants we grow in our landscape. One of the first things I learned when I started talking about this business, as opposed to just doing it at home, was that azaleas and rhododendrons are among the first plants that should get the hose in times of drought. Did you try to keep them watered a little bit?
Yeah, we did, but with the drought and everything, we didn't just want to waste water. And we're lucky around here; we have good wells, and our water is plentiful, but we don't want to waste it.
Right. And azaleas, I tend to associate with somewhat cooler climates. Are azaleas really common where you are?
Yes, they are. A lot of people have them, and ours are beautiful. We'd have people, take pictures of the kids in front of them with their Easter clothes on, and all that stuff. They were beautiful. And really, this is the only year we've ever had any trouble with them.
Okay, so how did they bloom in the spring for you?
They were just completely covered with blooms.
Okay, excellent. Did you trim them back after blooming at all?
No.
Okay, so you just left them alone.
And that's something else. They need pruning back. They're about to take over the front of my house.
Yeah, but this would be a terrible time to do it, because you say they are greening up a little bit, right?
Right.
I would urge you to sit on your pruners, because the time to have pruned them would be right after that wall of pink fell apart. As soon as, the last flower was faded, that's when you can really get in there, and you can reduce the size of the plant by up to one-third. With the caveat, because of where you are and how intensely hot it can get so quick in any year, not just the biblical one you just went through, that after you're done pruning, I want you to make sure that they don't go dry for the next month until they can seal all those pruning cuts. But the sign that they're green now just shows us how powerful these plants are, Pat. I think they're alive.
Well, I do too, but they're not totally green. It's just a little green here and there. You can see it coming back.
Yeah, but see, if you start pruning them now, you're going to release their stored moisture, and you're going to interfere with them trying to go dormant for the winter. How cold do your winters get?
It gets cold enough. We don't have very many times when it gets below zero. It'll get down in the 30s, but it won't stay there.
Yeah. If you lived in the Northeast, I'd say if you were willing to give up next year's bloom, you could prune them back in the winter. But you kind of don't even get a winter. Anything you would do, I would urge you to wait. If you want to prune them now and you can't wait till spring when we see what kind of flower we get, I'd still urge you to wait till January. But once we get to January, come on, Pat, you can wait until bloom time and then see what they do. And after bloom time is over, then you can shape them and reward them. But right now, the only thing I would suggest you do is continue to give them a little bit of supplemental water if things turn dry again. The inner reserves of these plants, if they're well cared for, can be surprising. And you don't want to interfere with them possibly coming back from the dead for you, which seems like it's a real possibility.
Yeah, that's right. Is there any kind of supplement I could use that's good for azaleas?
In the spring, as soon as the weather starts to warm up again normally, I would give them an inch of peat moss and an inch of compost over top of that and water that in. And that's what they really like. You could even give that to them in the middle of winter.
Okay. All right.
All right, Pat?
Well, that sounds good.
All right. Good luck. We'll be pulling for your azaleas, man.
Thank you, brother.
Take care, sir.
All right. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and ask all the ladies to leave the room for a minute. I have something to discuss that's for men only, you understand, right? Thanks. Okay, guys, are they gone? Listen up fast. Go out and get some holly. Bring it into the house right away. Because if holly comes into the house before ivy comes into the house at holiday time, men will rule the roost for the entire following year. But if ivy comes in before any holly, the women will be in charge again. But don't you go hacking away at helpless holly just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and how pounding some stakes into the ground outside your house can get rid of termites inside. It's amazing. You won't want to miss it. We'll be right back with more of You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath.
You're listening to You Bet Your Garden on WHYY.
Mike McGrath, right back at you with local events. The Holiday Green Sale at the Scott Arboretum of Swarthmore College and Christ Church Christiana in Greenville, Delaware, will run until 2 p.m. today. Historic Bartram's Garden will host their Holiday Green Sale today until 4 and tomorrow from 10 to 4. And the Pinelands Preservation Alliance will join up with other nonprofit conservation groups to host an ecologically oriented green trading post shopping experience from noon to 4 tomorrow at their headquarters at the Bishop Farmstead on Pemberton Road in Southampton Township, New Jersey. We'll post all the details at the events section of our website, youbetyourgarden.org.
WHYY forecast for today, mostly sunny with a high of about 49. Tonight, a few clouds about, the low dipping to the mid-30s. Sunny skies tomorrow, milder for Sunday, the high 58. And Monday, overcast with a high of 60.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to an astonishing question of the week, one whose answer amazed even me. Many people install chemical trenches around their house to prevent termites. Many people flip out if they find termites inside their house. Well, believe it or not, there's a simple, common sense, very low toxic solution that can take termites out of an infested house, and everything happens outdoors. You don't introduce anything to the home whatsoever, and there's no need for toxic trenches. We'll tell you all about it after a couple more year fascinating and phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. JD, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing good, JD. How are you, sir?
Pretty good.
And where is JD pretty good?
I'm in Paul's Valley, Oklahoma.
All right, what can we do for JD in Paul's Valley?
Well, I had a question. I have a very large red oak near my house. We live down in the trees with a lot of trees around.
Yeah.
And about 5 years ago, had a really major fire that had come through there. And so we have several trees with fire damage. And this one beautiful oak in particular, about a fourth of the way around the base of it and probably about 2 feet high, the bark is just burned off of it.
Burned and, off, not just charred?
No, you could peel it off down to underneath the bark, and it had gotten some termites even in the dead bark that was still on there.
Yeah. Okay.
And that we removed, and so what is left there is just kind of exposed down to the center wood.
Right.
With the bark surrounding. I didn't know if there's anything you can do to help the tree repair itself, or if it's just kind of left to its own devices.
Well, JD, you said the fire blew through several years ago.
Yes, it did.
And the tree has been leafing out normally every year?
Yes.
This is the miracle of trees, man, and it occurs in so many ways, shapes, and forms. We got a vicious snowstorm, 12 inches of wet snow when the trees still had all their leaves on them. So a lot of the trees were literally torn apart, like in a Godzilla movie, just like the branches didn't snap off. They took large portions of the trunks with them. And a lot of these trees are going to be fine because the other side of the trunk is still there to carry nutrients up to the canopy. The only thing that really endangers a tree in a situation like this is if it is girdled, if a complete right. circle is taken out. And one thing we've learned from studies, from science, from observation over the years is there is absolutely nothing we can do to aid the healing power of a tree. And 80% of what we would try would hold the tree back, would make it worse.
Mm-hmm.
The best thing to do is just allow the tree to continue to slowly heal itself. It will never really grow that outer bark back again, but it will grow a very subtle layer that will take the place of the bark over time. It can't replace that biomass, but it will slowly build up that layer of, I think it's called cambrium, and maybe even over time carry a little bit of nutrients up to the canopy. But what happens is the rest of the tree compensates, and the working parts take up everything the canopy of the tree needs to survive. It's just miraculous how these plants want to live. If any more termites show up, I do want you to paint the bark with a dilute solution of boric acid.
Okay.
As they try to eat the wood, they will get the boric acid in them. A dilute solution will not kill them. They'll take it back to the nest. It'll kill the queen, and that colony will stop trying to harvest that tree. So do keep an eye out for termites, and if they show up, a teaspoon or a tablespoon of boric acid in a pint of water, and make that on as large a scale as you need, and then just apply it with a paintbrush to the areas you see any termites, and that'll knock out the colony. That's really the only thing you need to watch out for.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mike.
All right. Good luck, JD.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Take care. 1-888-346-9499. Jerry, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Yes, hi.
Hello, Jerry. How are you?
Okay, fine.
And where is Jerry okay fine?
Northwestern Missouri.
Okay, very good to hear from you, sir. What can we do for you?
I've got Colorado blue spruce planted in 1982. And turned into beautiful trees. And one of them rubbed on the light company's transformer, and they took about 6 feet out of the top, right in the middle.
Oh, you poor guy.
Can I reshape it, or will it ever regain its better shape?
There are some trees, mostly deciduous trees, that the power company can remove the growing tips, and it's really just a pruning. But if you look at these beautiful evergreens that come to a point, you realize that this is really, in one sense, the growing part of the tree. A lot of the problems with blue spruces, when they get to be mature like yours, is you'll notice that the bottom branches will start to die off. generally from lack of sunlight. If it's a mature tree that gets light from all sides, those branches will stay very lush. But with most blue spruces, you got to admit, the bottom branches start to brown out, but the top of the tree is always extraordinary. I'm afraid there's very little you can do, especially considering that they took it out because it was rubbing against a transformer, so you really can't argue with them too much. And I would think that anything you'd want to do up at the top of that tree could be dangerous because you'd be working very close to some heavy-duty lines, right?
Well, actually, it's 6 feet below the lines.
Right now it is, right? What did you, you know, what a sin. When did this happen, Jer?
It's been 4 years ago, and it has kind of a rough valley on top. It doesn't seem to be getting its shape back.
No, it won't. It won't. It's almost like when a human loses a limb. That top was the integral part of the tree, the part that had vigor. Now, sometimes people will try to artificially recreate a new top. I mean, but we're talking about the kind of pruning that would almost be like topiary, Jer. You'd have to get up there and really beginning about a third of the way from the ground, begin taking branches back, you know, out at the ground level, maybe 6 feet, and then you go up a little bit, and then 5 feet, and then, you know, 4 feet, until you get to the top, and you would try to create another artificial kind of a top. But it will never look good. And by top, I'm shocked that this tree is still alive after 5 years.
Well, it looks like a beautiful tree. I mean, in terms of the green foliage, still looks good.
Well, if you want to attempt this, the best time to start trying to shape it would be the dead of winter through early spring. Don't do anything now because you don't want to stimulate growth with winter coming. Now, how tall is what's left, Jer?
It's probably 25, 30 feet right now.
And do you feel like you're able to reach it? I mean, because this to me sounds almost like a cherry picker, like a bucket job.
Some of these younger fellows around here might help me. I don't know.
Yeah, one thing you got to be very careful. I mean, because you're saying it's 6 feet below the power lines, but you get up to the top of the tree, you're a 6 foot tall guy in a bucket, and I see a bad movie happening there. So you always want to be careful, and this sounds like a job that you would want an arborist for. A lot of times these trees were planted too close to power lines, and what I tell people, when it becomes obvious the tree is going to be attacked by the power company, wait until mid-December, take it down yourself, and use the bottom for greens, and the tops of these big trees, if you're willing to put in the pruning work, they make magnificently full Christmas trees, and that way at least you get to enjoy it one last time. If you look at it and see the job I've described of actually taking the tree down and making it look like a much smaller tree would be too much work, you might want to consider felling it and using the body for ornamental greenery for the holidays.
Okay.
All right, Jer? Just be careful if you do wind up trying to reshape it, and good luck to you, sir.
All right, thank you. Bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week, which this week I'm calling Of Termites, Trenches, Toxins, and Traps. Our question comes from Carlos in Rockville, Maryland, who writes, Mike, my wife and I want to plant fruit trees, grapevines, and a vegetable garden. But our yard is currently grass that's been treated with chemicals for several years. Can we just remove the grass and plant, or should we replace some of the soil? And we want to place the vegetable garden near the foundation on one side of our home. But a friend warned that this might not be a good idea, as that soil was treated for termites before the house went in 6 years ago. Do you know how far our trench of death extends from the foundation? We would like to plant as close to the house as possible. Well, Carlos, the lawn part is easy. In a nutshell, with the full nut being detailed in a previous question of the week we'll link up to, You measure off sections for raised beds that are no wider than 4 feet, with 2-foot-wide walking lanes in between them. You remove the grass in the areas that'll become the beds, lay down cardboard, install frames that are about 1 foot high, and fill them with a mixture of screened black topsoil and high-quality compost. None of your dirt. This eliminates any possibly contaminated soil and prevents any remaining grassy areas from invading your growing space, which is a guaranteed problem in flat ground gardens around lawns. Raised beds also look much more attractive, require much less work, and produce a much better harvest. Just plant those fruits in open areas that get morning sun. It'll take several years for them to grow their first edibles, and by then your past sins should be erased, as long as you get off the chemical treadmill, of course. Now, for your trench of terror, we turn to noted common sense pest control specialist Bill Quarles, director of the BIRC, the Biointegral Resource Center in Berkeley, California, and editor of the IPM Practitioner, whose latest issue features a lengthy comparison of chemically filled trenches and bait stations for termite control. It turns out that these trenches are just a poor idea in many ways. First, of course, you're actually paying people to surround your house with a toxic moat. But the chemicals in that ditch of death peter out over time, and after 5 years or so begin to fail at their appointed task. So you spend a lot of money, endure a lot of potential exposure, and the product stops working fairly soon. Now, the fact that your moat of mayhem has probably lost a lot of its spark does not mean that you should plant there. Any planting right up against the house would increase your risk of invasion by subterranean termites, which are the only type that's common in your northeast mid-Atlantic location. All these creatures need to gain access to a home's foundation is for the soil to be constantly moist all the way to the wall, and a watered and mulched garden would create a superhighway for them. One of the best ways to prevent subterranean termite invasion is to simply leave an 18-inch wide space around the perimeter of your home clear of everything. Plants, mulch, stones, etc., explains Quarles. The termites don't like to travel through dry areas, and anything growing or covering the surface of the soil would keep it moist and termite attractive. Bill adds that the typical trench of terror is a couple of feet deep, starts right up against the foundation, and initially extends out about 8 inches, but significant amounts of the chemicals can migrate out as far as 3 feet. So for safety and future termite avoidance, not to mention good airflow behind your plants, build your raised beds at least 4 feet or so away from the foundation. And of course, don't mulch the area right next to the house, and do anything you can to keep that area dry, which is also going to be good for the house itself. Now, options to these caustic canals abound. Bill points out that a sand barrier is very inexpensive to install as a home is being built, is highly effective against termite invasion, and doesn't wear out. Also highly effective and totally non-toxic, a stainless steel barrier should last for about 25 years. But the hands-down winner is outdoor bait stations, stake-like devices that are driven into the ground around the perimeter of a home. The tops flip up so that inspectors can see if there's any activity or missing bait, while the below-ground bottoms allow termites to enter and take the bait, which is treated with the latest and safest termite colony killer. The termites take the treated bait back to their nest, where it kills the queen and ends the threat from that specific colony. How well do these bait stations work? Bill explains that to be approved in Florida, where termite pressure is enormous, outdoor bait stations have to clear infestations inside an already infested home 90% of the time or better. You heard me. Outdoor bait stations have to show that they will clear at least 90% of infested homes of their already existing indoor termite problems. How is this possible? Simple, explains Bill. These subterranean termites live in big colonies outdoors and send workers inside structures to get food. The bait stations attract termites from the colony. They take the bait back to the nest where it kills the queen. And with no new workers being produced, the indoor problem quickly ends, all without you spraying anything toxic inside or outside. I don't know about you, but this is the best news I've heard all year. Well, that sure was important information about non-toxic ways to deter termites, now wasn't it? Luckily for yous, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To carefully review this informative article, with links to the BIRC and information about how to obtain their excellent termite prevention publications, just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes! My producer is threatening to pound bait stations around me if I don't get out of this studio. Ha! Like I'm going to go chasing after little chunks of wood in the... Hey, is that fresh-baked soft pretzels I smell? Are they in those things over there sticking out of the ground? Whoa, hey, we must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live, put the actual subject in the subject line, and check first to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week. Find the solution to hundreds of garden problems, hint, hint, just like yours, hint, hint, in our Garden Answers A to Z section. And or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Kevin Love Train Griffin. Our webmasters are Baneful Rich Banowitz and Sarah the She-Devil Kazar. Alexis Landis produces and co-edits You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. She also books our guests, keeps in touch with our affiliate stations, and sells popcorn in the stands in between innings. Our production assistant, Julia Worski, slaves over a hot computer all day. Our editor, Al Banks, well, he keeps our studios termite-free. I'm slightly nibbled but still structurally sound, Mike McGrath, and I'll see you next week. Can you grow your own artichokes? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss how people outside of California can attempt to coax this edible thistle along. Plus your fabulous phone calls.
Mike, with his rakish rep, helps us to a robust and resplendent garden, a raconteur on rhubarb, roses, rhododendron, and more. Join Mike every Saturday morning at 11 on You Bet Your Garden, here on WHYY.